This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear an update on some of the things that have been happening in Guantanamo. Our government is trying to send some of the detainees back to their home countries, where they surely face torture.
From one legal black hole to another, all the Bush administration can do is deepen that black hole.
We'll talk with documentary filmmaker Lyra Porras Garzón about her new film, Flying While Muslim.
She tells the stories of dozens of Muslims who've been discriminated against post 9/11.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. We want to update you about Guantanamo. It's been 3 years since the Supreme Court in Razul versus Bush, the major case for the Center for Constitutional Rights, decided that Bush and company can't just put people in prison and throw away the key. That's been litigated now for 3 years. The center has filed an important brief that's going to the Supreme Court. That was done 2 weeks ago. We have our own Michael Ratner here to talk about the importance of this new brief and what the conditions in Guantanamo are to this day and what the government's been doing. Michael, bring us up to date.
Thanks, Michael. Well, I'm sure as most of our listeners know, we cover this issue quite extensively, Guantanamo and what's happening with the writ of habeas corpus, the right to go to a court and challenge your detention. The center began what Michael described as the Razul case, which was decided in June 2004, began that case in 2002. This anniversary of 9/11 coming up will mean that the clients at Guantanamo have been in prison at Guantanamo for almost 6 years, a very, very long time, without ever having a day in court. In some way, the whole story of the Guantanamo litigation reminds me of that Greek mythical figure Sisyphus, where you roll the stone up to the top of the hill, you think you're about to go over the top, and then some force rolls it back down over you. Michael's point was in 2004, the Supreme Court did decide that the people at Guantanamo had the right to go to court and the government had to come up with legitimate, valid, legal, constitutional reasons for holding people in an offshore penal colony. Sadly, after that Razul decision, our wonderful Congress, at that time controlled by the Republicans, but sadly a number of Democrats going along with those Republicans, passed the Detainee Treatment Act, which reversed the Supreme Court decision because the Supreme Court decision was on a statutory basis and not a constitutional basis, so Congress simply changed the statute. That went up to the Supreme Court again in the Hamden case in 2006. Again, the Supreme Court said, Congress, you didn't do it right. We're holding that there still is a writ of habeas corpus for these people and that they can still go to court. Congress gets a hold of it again, and as people again are probably familiar with, the infamous Military Commission Act, signed in the fall of 2006, this time takes away habeas corpus again in a way that leaves no doubt that Congress did it. Again, sadly, number of Democrats going along with it, and even those that didn't, and it still gets me, people like Senator Leahy, who said it was the worst single piece of legislation and that habeas is, you know, destroyed now. Even people like Senator Leahy, who talks big but refused to filibuster the bill, didn't do it. The Democrats could have done that probably had the votes to do it, didn't do it. So they passed the Military Commission Act and again stripped of habeas. So now we're in the Supreme Court for the third time. That's not one, that's not two, that's three. And this time the Supreme Court will decide whether our Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, gives the people at Guantanamo the right to go to court and challenge their detention by a writ of habeas corpus. The argument will take place on December 5th. There are now a mass of lawyers on it, of course, including the Center for Constitutional Rights, filing one of the major briefs in the case as part of our original set of clients in the case. We submitted our briefs in August. The issues, not to be too legalistic with our audience, but are really two. One is, does the Constitution protect the writ of habeas corpus for people at Guantanamo and in other offshore penal colonies around the world? And two, if it does the procedure that Congress set up, and this is a little complicated, that Congress set up a procedure for some kind of hearings at Guantanamo, their BS kangaroo court little hearings at Guantanamo with only military people and no lawyers.
The use of hearsay and torture evidence. I mean, that thing's a joke.
And so that the court will be deciding two things, whether the Guantanamo people are protected by the writ of habeas corpus in the Constitution, and if they are, whether the so-called procedure that Congress set up at Guantanamo, which as Michael just described, allows hearsay, torture, no lawyer, et cetera, is an adequate alternative to that.
The Supreme Court initially said, let's try out these two laws and see how they work. Come back to us later. Out of nowhere, they said, nah, come back to us now. We want to hear it now. That was really an extraordinary thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, sort of complicated wrinkle here. After the Military Commission Act, we went to court, and we went to the Supreme Court ultimately, and they said, well, we're not going to hear that yet. We want to see whether the procedures Congress has set up adequately protect your clients. And they denied review. And then that was in maybe April of 2007. And then 2 months later, almost the last week of the term, possibly the last week, the end of June, they reversed themselves and said, we want to hear this case now. Now, that is very unusual. Once the court denies review, for them to go back and say, we now want to review this case is extremely, extremely unusual.
Maybe I'm being optimistic. I was thinking maybe they initially denied review because the good guys on the court figured they didn't have the votes. And maybe they picked up a vote. Is that naive?
No, I think that's very possible that there were three people against us. There'll always be those three people against us. And that's Alito.
The honor roll here.
Right. Alito, Roberts, and Thomas. Those guys basically can't even count them. They're just negative votes. The two in the middle, Stevens and Kennedy. Stevens probably with us. Kennedy is the swing vote now in the court because there's four, you wouldn't call them liberals, but four essential people who still believe the Constitution has some meaning. And then there's three who don't. And then there's these two guys, Stevens and Kennedy. Kennedy being the swing vote. It is conceivable that what happened is Kennedy was uncomfortable with reviewing the case in April because he wanted to see what the procedures looked like. He got very uncomfortable, more uncomfortable with what was actually going on at Guantanamo because there was actually one of the people who sat on the military little courts down there. A guy named Abraham came out with an affidavit. It was submitted to the court that said this thing is just an outrage, what's going on here. That's a summary of what he said, but he was pretty shocked by it. And so I think Kennedy probably reversed himself and said, let's hear this case. So a large part of our brief goes into all the inadequacies, the really unfairness of the procedures at Guantanamo.
The United States Supreme Court has said it won't prevent Ahmed Belbashah, an Algerian army veteran detained at Guantanamo Bay, from being transferred to his home country. Belbashah, who has been held at Guantanamo for 5 years, has argued that he will be tortured if turned over to Algerian officials. He is one of nearly 20 detainees there who say they will face abuse if sent back to their country. Today we are joined by Emmy McLean, attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, to talk more about the repatriations of Guantanamo detainees.
Well, Emmy McLean, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on.
You've been working on the legal end of this ever-evolving story down in Guantanamo, and we understand now the government is sending people back to places they don't want to go. What precisely is going on now?
First of all, it's great to be here. The issue is that there are a number of people who are detained at Guantanamo who were, before they were picked up, refugees who had fled from their home countries for fear of persecution. Some of them had even been granted refugee status in the country that they had fled to or by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Now they're in Guantanamo, and because the U.S. has so stigmatized them, has labeled them as killers despite the fact that they don't have evidence to be able to support any charges against them, and now there's not a country that is accepting them. And so the U.S. is willing and actively sending people to countries despite the fact that there is a known and substantial risk that they will be tortured upon their return. They've sent someone to Libya. They've recently sent two people to Tunisia despite the fact that these are known human rights abusing regimes and that the individuals who were sent back had individualized fears that when they were going to be sent back, they're tortured. All of these individuals, as far as we know, are still detained and do not have any likelihood of due process within the regimes that they're in.
Emmy, has the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a suit in any of this? I understand the Supreme Court said it wouldn't prevent one of these individuals from Algeria from being transferred.
Yes. One of our clients is a Libyan who the United States government has several times expressed that they intend to send him back to Libya, despite the fact that he had fled Libya. Libya is a regime which is notorious for abusing human rights. And this individual was alleged by the United States, without any evidence, of course, was alleged by the United States while he was in Guantanamo as being affiliated with a group that was opposed to the Libyan regime. The United States was willing to send him back to Libya, even though it was undisputed that he was at grave risk of torture and other forms of persecution if he were returned to Libya. We brought that case up through the court system, and because of the Military Commissions Act, which removed the jurisdiction of the courts to consider cases of all sorts of the men who were detained at Guantanamo, the Supreme Court and every court below the Supreme Court refused to consider this issue. And just last week, in the case of an Algerian, Ahmed Belbacha, the Supreme Court said that they would not consider an emergency effort to try to prevent his transfer to Algeria.
When are these transfers slated to happen?
One of the main problems that we experience at the Center for Constitutional Rights and the lawyers who are representing individual detainees through the center, we don't get advance notice. And especially now, with the Military Commissions Act and the jurisdiction stripping provisions and the limited ability to be able to bring any sort of litigation within the courts to try to challenge any aspect of treatment or detention, we have very limited avenues to try to be able to get information prior to someone's transfer to try to prevent a transfer and bring to light the risk that someone would face if they were transferred.
Well, Attorney Emmy McLean, you said jurisdiction stripping. I think we have to explain to our audience what that means. We all grew up thinking if a person was illegally detained somewhere, they had a right to have a lawyer. The lawyer could take their case to a judge, and the judge could decide whether or not that person had a right to go to court and learn what was being charged against them and to advocate on their behalf. And is there something different about Guantanamo now?
Unfortunately, as we've learned too well and very much the hard way, and the men who were detained in Guantanamo have learned in the hardest way possible, something is very different that's happening now than has happened before. Guantanamo was created as a black hole. Guantanamo was created as a place where people could be held outside of the reach of any sort of law. And since Guantanamo was created in 2002 for this purpose, the detention facilities were created for this purpose, we have done everything within our power to try to bring it back within the reach of the law, to be able to demonstrate that the most fundamental rights, the rights that this country is founded on, the rights that our democratic system are founded on, rights that should apply in this context, that we cannot create a place that is outside of the reach of the law and allow that to continue.
But didn't the Military Commission Act that was recently passed take those rights you've just talked about totally away and prevent people from going to court to challenge their being locked up?
That is exactly what the Military Commissions Act tried to do, and that is exactly the reason why we are going to be before the Supreme Court again this year to challenge what Congress tried to do within the Military Commissions Act. What Congress tried to do with the Military Commissions Act was to remove the rights of Guantanamo detainees to bring cases challenging the legality of their detention to court. And they went even beyond that. Congress, within the Military Commissions Act, removed the rights of detainees, or attempted to remove the rights of detainees, to challenge any aspect of their conditions of confinement, of their treatment, of their transfer. And they did it not just for the men who were detained in Guantanamo, but for anyone who is a non-citizen, who is classified as an enemy combatant, or who is, and this is one of the more absurd parts of it, awaiting determination about whether they would be classified as an enemy combatant.
What if these people are tortured? Can they sue?
At the Center for Constitutional Rights, our assertion is that they still have the right to bring these challenges that we've been bringing, and that's the reason why we're going before the Supreme Court this year, to be able to demonstrate that the Military Commissions Act and the jurisdiction stripping provisions within it are unconstitutional.
Emmy, do you have information on anyone who has been returned and what have been the consequences since?
Yes. There was a Libyan who was returned at the end of last year, and there were two Tunisians who were recently returned in June of this year. All of them are detained still.
In
their home countries. And at least one of the Tunisians was convicted in absentia. While he was in Guantanamo, he was convicted without ever appearing before a court, based presumably in part on allegations that were made against him, perhaps based on information that the United States provided. It's not clear. So the United States sent him back knowing that he had a conviction and a sentence of decades in Tunisia. So the information that has come out at this point is that the two Tunisians that have been there have been abused and mistreated, threatened with abuse to themselves and to their family members, and lawyers who went to Tunisia to try to find out more information were denied access to the Tunisians who were there. And Libya, for the man who was sent back to Libya, there's virtually no ability to get information about them. There's really no civil society in Libya, and we have some information that he's still detained and that there's no fair process that is set up to be able to allow him to challenge that detention.
So, in fact, they've gone from one black hole in Guantanamo to another.
That is exactly right, and that's exactly what we're trying to stop, to try to find ways for the men who are detained in Guantanamo who are unable to return to their home countries for fear of persecution to get refuge in a country where they can be safe.
And remind our listeners, how many men are still remaining in Guantanamo right now?
There are over 350 people who are still detained in Guantanamo over 5 years after Guantanamo opened as an offshore black hole to detain people.
We had a guest on several years ago, Professor Al McCoy from the University of Wisconsin, who had written a book on torture. And it was his documentation that was just so impressive to us, that it was the United States government that developed torture methods, and that those methods that they spent hundreds of millions of dollars in perfecting were indeed the methods that were being used to this very day on people, and particularly people at Guantanamo. And some of the things that he cited were things that we've just discussed in terms of what they're doing to these people. Heat and cold, sleep deprivation, humiliation, cultural humiliation, stress positions, so that a person is responsible for their own pain and they're told that we'll let you out of this position if you tell us this or that. Has there been a successful calling to account of the U.S. government for what they've done to these people in Guantanamo?
We continue to be working to try to challenge the abusive treatment in the public sphere and also within the courts. I can't say, unfortunately, that there has been a successful challenge, but it's not going to stop us from continuing to try to challenge the abuses that have gone on and that are continuing to go on at Guantanamo in different forms from the way that they were perpetrated in 2002, but still in very, very severe ways.
So Emmy McLean from the Center for Constitutional Rights, when Bush gets on TV and says, the United States, we do not torture, what do you say?
Look at the evidence. We've all seen the evidence, and it goes beyond, you know, what the administration calls a few bad apples in Abu Ghraib. We know that what happened at Abu Ghraib, what happened in Iraq, is much bigger than that, goes to the highest levels of this administration. We know that what is happening in the ghost secret CIA detention facilities has been approved the highest levels of this administration. One of our clients at Guantanamo underwent a torture regime that was signed off on by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. We know, we have clear evidence over the last 5+ years of torture happening perpetrated by the United States in different places, different countries, different contexts. It is absolutely not true that we do not torture. It is absolutely true that we should not torture and that it is illegal under any circumstances to torture.
Emmy, how difficult is it to actually get down to Guantanamo as an attorney to visit clients there?
It has been incredibly difficult to get to Guantanamo, and it's actually increasingly difficult now with the Military Commissions Act as well. It took the Center for Constitutional Rights 2 years to get to Guantanamo when the first men who were detained there. It took us longer than that to get information about who was detained there, what the circumstances were of their detention. Now, because of the Military Commissions Act, the Federal Appeals Court in Washington, D.C. determined that the habeas cases that we had brought were invalid and could not be brought.
And how many were those?
There were around 200 petitioners who were represented in habeas cases who are still detained in Guantanamo. So because of that, there are increasing limitations on access to the base and to the men who are detained in Guantanamo, many of whom now are detained in much more serious conditions of solitary confinement than they had been detained in the past.
And their mental states, in addition to their physical states, must be deteriorating.
Their mental states are deteriorating rapidly. There's one example that I can give of people who are transferred to what are super maximum security confinement facilities. These, remember, are men who have not been charged with any crime, not been convicted with any crime, many of whom were acknowledged by a CIA report in 2002, 5 years ago, as being mostly men who were caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. They're held in super maximum security confinement, one of whom had been cleared for release, who was a refugee, a Chinese minority who could not be returned to his home country. After only a few weeks in this super maximum security confinement facility, his attorney visited him, and the man said to his attorney, "Tell my wife she should remarry. She should consider me dead." This is a man who had given up all hope of any alternative solution except for indefinite detention in Guantanamo.
And how can you blame them?
And how can you blame him? I mean, this is what has been going on in Guantanamo has been going on for far too long. A day is too long, and over 5 years is abominable.
Emmy McLean, how did you get involved in this work? You've recently graduated law school, got admitted to the bar. Listeners can't see you, but I can, and it looks to me like you haven't practiced more than 10 years or so. And just for our listeners are very interested in how people get involved in this work and what it is that motivates them and so on. Can you share with us some of your thoughts about what led you to do this kind of litigation?
Well, I've been incredibly inspired by the work of the Center for Constitutional Rights that has taken on this case from the very beginning, has not felt threatened by statements by the administration that these are the worst of the worst, has said that we need to actually hear them out. We need to see who these people are, and we need to demand that the government presents evidence that someone is detained for a particular reason, that we can prove that there is a legitimacy in the detention. And this is a fundamental right that I know that our country is founded on and that I felt it was absolutely important to be involved in.
Where are you from originally?
I'm from Boston originally.
A town with a conscience.
I'm from a town with a conscience. I have politically oriented parents, definitely.
Were your parents 60s radicals?
My parents were politically involved in their own ways, but they were not, they were not politically involved at a very high level, but they definitely instilled within me a conscience. And I've also, lived in different areas, in different areas both within the United States and outside of the United States, where I've seen what I want to see in a society and I've seen what I don't want to see in a society. I've seen the ways that we've excluded people, that we have labeled someone as an other in our society, and I've seen how that's happened in other environments as well.
Now, the Guantanamo work can get pretty depressing. What sort of keeps you inspired through this?
There's an incredible team of people that are working on these issues who are willing to stand up for fundamental values, for fundamental rights, no matter what barriers are put in front of us. And it is an incredibly inspiring, wonderful, warm, committed group of people that I feel honored to be part of.
Do you plan to travel to Guantanamo if possible?
Likely. But, no definitive plans at the moment. And it sort of obviously depends on how things develop. I would hope, of course, that I don't have the opportunity to visit Guantanamo, because I would hope that by the time I get security clearance, Guantanamo will be shut down, as people both within the United States, within the administration, and outside in other countries have been urging to happen immediately.
What concerns me, Emmy, is that there's some loose talk about shutting down Guantanamo, but at the same time, they're talking about opening up similar facilities here on the mainland.
Yeah, it is a great concern. It is not a solution to shut down Guantanamo without a real plan to say that when Guantanamo is shut down, the men should either be tried within fair processes or released. It is not an answer to say shut down Guantanamo and bring them into U.S. facilities outside of the reach of the law within the United States. It is not a solution to say shut down Guantanamo and transfer them to countries where they are at grave risk of torture, abuse, or indefinite detention in a different context.
We've shattered so many lives, not only of the men down there, but their families and extended families. It's really criminal.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I've met now people who have been released from Guantanamo who are living in other countries and who've been released, you know, several years earlier and who are still deeply, deeply affected by what happened to them at Guantanamo, deeply affected in terms of their sense of what the United States is, what justice is, of course, but also just deeply affected in their personal lives in ways that they will never recover from.
Emmy, have you noticed an increase in media coverage on Guantanamo? I haven't really been tracking it over the years. Is it still sort of sporadic?
It certainly depends on the issue, depends on what is actually happening within the court, within the public eye. It depends on what's happening within the international arena. But there's definitely, I sense, a growing awareness that what is happening there is something that we do not want to be associated with, that is detrimental to our country in the long run, that is detrimental to, you know, whatever sort of international efforts we are pursuing.
There's a fear always, I think, that even when we were so astounded at the first sort of specter of the U.S. using torture, but now, I hate to say it, but it almost becomes commonplace because we hear about it, nothing gets done, people sort of become acclimated to it, so I just hope that doesn't set in even more.
Yeah, I think this is one of the major problems that we see from how the administration has operated within this new dynamic that they've created. There is an effort by the administration, by the president, by the vice president, by others to sanitize the language that we use, to not talk about torture, but to talk about certain kinds of techniques that we're using that are indirect or that are more severe types of interrogation, but that they don't rise to the level of torture. What we're doing right now is torture. What we're doing right now is disappearing people. We need to use the language that speaks to what is actually happening and not try to sanitize what we're talking about.
I think that Cheney himself approved of waterboarding, which is when they put somebody on a board and hold them underwater and simulate drowning, and the person feels like they're going to die. And that's something that they're currently using now. You know, what concerns me is that the rights that you've been articulating are the kind of things that we learned about in school, you know, the Bill of Rights and the various freedoms associated with it. I don't know that there's that high of an awareness now what those rights are. And I also think that the media, with the exception of stations like Pacifica stations that are alternative sources of news, but the media generally plays the role of dumbing people down. So they don't get much information to begin with when they're going to school, and they don't get much more when they get out of school. And the kind of rights that the Center for Constitutional Rights so passionately defends are not the rights that people assume are guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States.
I think that's true. I was also thinking as you were speaking, Emmy, that vis-a-vis the disappeared torture. I mean, if you watch popular television right now, everyone knows there's a rash of criminal investigation programs. There's a program on the FBI looking into missing people. It almost translates, I think we deal with some of these difficult topics by fictionalizing them, making them Hollywood. And yet the reality is, as Michael says, people have become numb or unaware of what their rights are. And when we deal with them in reality, it's just almost too difficult. But they're all just essential human rights.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. We've dealt in these hypotheticals, too, a lot of times. I mean, this came up in the Republican debates where I think it was the Fox News-sponsored debate. There was an effort to try to create this absolutely hypothetical scenario. There are, you know, nuclear attacks in one place. There's all these people that are captured. They're transferred here. What do we do? Do we torture them? Are you willing to torture them? You put someone in that kind of scenario, that's not the scenario that the CIA, that the FBI, that the actual people who are on the ground who are dealing with these issues say that they're facing. And they say that they want real leadership, real support. They say that they want a real rule of law that they can trust and that they can believe in and that has existed in prior administrations.
Given that what people say under torture is notoriously unreliable and that the rule of law, habeas corpus, has existed since the 13th century, and the other rights that are built into our Constitution seem to be working for all these years. How do you explain why, with the Bush administration, they outright torture people? Why do they do this?
I probably look like I'm in a state of shock, in part because I can't imagine getting inside the head of President Bush or Vice President Cheney and trying to understand why they have led us down the path that they've led us down over the last 5 years. There's a sense that they do this because there is a desire to increase executive power to the greatest extent possible, to not have any of the limitations of the law that they don't feel that they are obliged to have, to prevent Congress from stepping in and intervening and allowing the laws that Congress has passed to put any limits on the actions of the administration. It is clear to us that the men who are detained in Guantanamo, the men who are detained in ghost detention facilities, are more than anything a pawn in an attempt to increase executive power to the greatest extent possible.
You know, Amy, I agree with you. For all the years we've been doing this show and we've been thinking about the question of why they torture, why they do what they're doing, and that's been our answer too, that they do it because they can do it.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I wish this weren't the case, but I think it is. I was at the office late at night and happened to, a couple nights ago, and happened to play one of the recordings of the combatant status review tribunals, these administrative review boards that exist at Guantanamo that we all know to be a complete sham. No attorneys are present. Information that is obtained through torture can be used. There's secret evidence the detainee cannot have access to. And this was actually the first time that I listened to a recording of a combatant status review tribunal.
Yeah, these were set
up
by the Military Commission Act, which threw out habeas corpus, no?
They were established before that. They were actually established after Rasul v. Bush in 2004, after we won the right to be able to challenge the detentions in court, of course, a right that has not been actualized. And they were established as an effort by the administration to demonstrate that, yes, they do have a process, despite the fact that they had had no process up until then. So they created a sham process. And I have to say, it just broke my heart, sitting in an office at, you know, midnight, listening to this man who clearly was in the wrong place at the wrong time. He was someone who had been a farmer. He had been, you know, transported somewhere and then was picked up by someone who told him he was going to be brought to be able to return to his home. In the end, he ended up being brought to a U.S. military base. We have heard stories over the years, and we've seen actual evidence of the flyers that the U.S. government has distributed across Afghanistan and Pakistan, offering wealth and power beyond your dreams. And that's an actual quote from one of these flyers for people who would turn over suspected militants. Now, you know, your friend and your neighbor is a suspected militant if you can get wealth and power beyond your dreams. And someone that you don't even know is definitely a suspected militant if you can get wealth and power beyond your dreams. And this man just said with utter shock, you know, he said, it wouldn't be so funny if you were just accusing me of one of the things that you're accusing me of, but you're accusing me of all of these things. It's not possible to actually do all of these things. And the tribunal board members were asking him things like, Is your country a Muslim country? I don't understand how it's possible that someone in your country could have, you know, these kinds of experiences that they were having. Just because the tribunal members had absolutely no idea the context that he was in, did not have an understanding of how someone could be picked up. A lot of this is born from the fact that there was no structure that was in place, and we were acting, the United States military, the United States government was acting in a place that it did not understand. And the reality is, this man, who had a tribunal hearing that was a complete sham, painful to listen to, in 2004, is still detained 3 years later. They were promising things like $5,000, $10,000, huge sums of money for people in desperately poor villages to be able to turn people over. And there was no process that was in place, no understanding why someone would be in Pakistan or would be in Afghanistan.
Go back to the fact of 9/11. 15 of the 19 people that were responsible for flying two planes into the World Trade Center were from America's ally, Saudi Arabia. And moreover, a number of these people had been trained and supported by the United States and sent to fight in Afghanistan against the Russians. And moreover, when a lot of these people came to the United States, their presence was known here. When they enlisted in the schools to learn how to fly airplanes, their presence was known here. The FBI reported on these people being here. So the whole fantasy that they've created since 9/11 about this external terrorist threat making all Muslims guilt because they're Muslims is just one of those great travesties of history that you could have never imagined before could have been pulled off. It's just really been just this extraordinary, really inexplicable phenomena that's descended on this country. And it's people like you that are trying to unravel it.
It's been a real honor to have you with us. We look forward to having you on again. We thank you and the Center for all the fabulous work that you're doing. It's really, you know, a labor of, as you've said, a moral conscience and love. Thank you.
Thank you, Emmy.
Thank you.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Since 9/11, many people around the country have been working on a daily basis to combat the discrimination that Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians have faced by our government on a day-to-day basis on the streets. We have Lyra Porras-Garzon to share with us her new documentary film, Flying While Muslim. This film explores the personal stories and the debate surrounding racial profiling after 9/11 in the U.S. As Lyra researched many of the personal stories, she unearthed countless reports of racial profiling from detainment in airports to illegal detention. We're pleased to have her with us in studio to discuss this new film. So, Lyra, tell us about the film.
Flying While Muslim, Racial Profiling Post 9/11, is a documentary that has been actually been filming since last year. And it's a story that highlights the issue of racial/religious profiling in the Arab, Muslim, and South Asian community. But beyond that, what we're trying to do is not only highlight and create awareness, but try to find legal remedies to the issue and have a legal platform for people to actually have certain perpetrators, either individuals or institutional, to be accountable for certain actions of racial or religious profiling.
What were some of the things in your discovery while filming this that you were really surprised by?
Well, we actually did a lot of man-on-the-street interviews as well, and we were actually startled by the revelation that a lot of people, and they're not just belonging to a particular race or a particular religion, but even part of the white majority who actually agree that racial profiling exists. And it's directed against not only for African Americans, but also for Arabs and Muslims. And this has been highlighted post 9/11, and that there is a need to create and open a space for dialogue and talk about this issue.
So tell us about some of the stories that you cover in your film.
One of the most moving stories, actually, is that of Talat Hamdani, whose son, Muhammad Salman Hamdani, he was found missing after the 9/11 attacks. And the U.S. media and government accused him of being a terrorist. Then it was discovered that he died helping World Trade victims. And so the statement from the media and the U.S. administration was basically recanted, and they called him a hero, even mentioned him in the U.S. Patriot Act. Now, there is actually a scholarship that was created by Rockefeller University in honor of Salman Hamdani. Now, this is a wonderful example of how tragedy is being translated into something positive, and it also carries the legacy of Salman by his mother. The problem, though, is that a lot of the people who are still caught in the crossfire when it comes to faith-based or ethnic profiling, a lot of these people don't have the same option or don't have the same kind of quote-unquote redemption as Salman has been able to witness, after his death.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned that as the first story, because previously I worked at the ACLU, as you know, for almost 4 years after 9/11, working on post-9/11 backlash. And part of my job there was to go around the country and to talk about the policies and the practices that came about and why they're wrong and why they won't help to make us safer and why they endanger every single one of us. And I found that one of the most effective ways was to tell stories, just real human stories about individuals. And the story that I always started out with was the story of Mohammed Salman Hamdani, which you described. He was a Pakistani Muslim kid, grew up in Queens, and, you know, helped his father in the candy store, worked as an EMT, worked as something like a volunteer firefighter, always carried with him in his backpack a copy of the Quran, an emergency medical kit in case he ever needed to stop and help someone. And that was part of his personality. He was far away from the World Trade Center Ground Zero at the time the towers would have struck, but apparently using his EMT ID, he managed to hitch a ride all the way down to the site and to help people while they were trying to get out. When the towers crumbled, he apparently disappeared into the mess. And his family immediately knew when he didn't come home that he had gone down to help somehow. And then they had heard that the government was rounding Muslim men up, young Muslim men. And they said, oh, well, that's a dream come true. He might be one of them. He might be in prison. He might be one of the many hundreds of Muslim men disappeared in America. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Because he wouldn't be dead. And turns out then he was wanted, as you mentioned, by, there were wanted posters put up with in federal agencies with his face on it. And the only thing that made him a suspect was that he had a chemistry background in school and he was Muslim. And later they found the lower parts of his body in the rubble many months later. It was April 2002, I believe, when they found the lower parts of his body at the World Trade Center site. And they were able to identify that through DNA. And they went to go visit the parents who, it was on the eve of their departure to Mecca, where they were going, the holiest city in Islam, where they were going to pray for their son's safe return. And it was extremely touching because, like you said, he had been vilified for so many months and their neighbors had known, and it had been in the papers that this homegrown Queens kid was a suspected terrorist. Do you have some stories of people in there fighting back?
Well, I mean, there's a story basically of Kuldeep Singh. And the most interesting part about the story of Kuldeep is that he's a Sikh. And so he's neither Arab and he's not Muslim either. But the thing is, there is still a court case that's being filed against the cop. But what happened was that Kuldeep was at home. A cop saw his van park in front of his house, of Kuldeep's house, and then I think the registration was expired. So the cop went down out of his car, went to Kuldeep's house, and then one thing led to another. Argument ensued, and the cop basically, and Kuldeep was unarmed, and the cop started beating Kuldeep and threw xenophobic remarks at him, such as, you f***ing Arab, pardon the language, you f***ing Arab, you f***ing immigrant, get out of my f***ing country, or I'll throw you out. And those were the things that was thrown against at Kuldeep. And then there's also like other stories as well. We have the Ibrahim sisters. And this is like the most blatant act of racial profiling of a particular ethnicity or religion. Because they were detained for 6 hours in JFK along with 200 other individuals who were obviously either Arab, Muslim, or South Asian. And for 6 hours, they had no access to food or water or any phone call whatsoever. And they were detained there, and then they were questioned by local authorities such as, well, I mean, you are, because their background is Iraqi, they're of Iraqi descent, and they migrated here in 1992. And some of the questions asked were, when they were in Jordan for their holiday, when they went back to the States, they were asked, well, did you have weapons training in the Middle East when you were there? Mm-hmm. You know, like, what do you think of the Iraq War? You know, things like this were asked. And there were, their mother wasn't even around when they were questioned.
How old were they?
They're in college, so maybe like 18, maybe.
They were 18 at the time?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. So what period of time do the stories featured in your film span?
Well, basically, we're covering a lot of things that existed post-9/11. And the stories, though, that's quite interesting, is that the stories of the Ibrahim sisters, for example, only occurred last year. And the same with Ra'i Jarar or Kuldeep, which has occurred this year as well. So, you know, it shows that even after years, I mean, post-9/11, this thing still exists. Racial profiling still exists. And that there is a certain atmosphere of fear that envelopes us. And we are being spoon-fed an illusion of safety that we're in the government conjurer's powers that allows them to misuse it. And at the same time, the media also, or parts of the media, has been accountable for this dereliction on the part of the government. And it's very unfortunate, but it exists.
What do you hope to accomplish with your film?
Well, number one is that we really want for people to question, is racial profiling effective? Is it an effective policy, or is it an effective practice? But is it effective, full stop? Another is, it is a human rights, civil rights violation. This has nothing to do with race. This has nothing to do with ethnicity or religion. This is a human rights and civil rights violation.
Yeah, the name of your media company, what's it called?
Media for Human Rights.
Media for Human Rights. How did you come about with that?
There is a need to use storytelling to create social change. And I think the power of stories, either through print, radio, or TV, but at least for us, for documentaries, is that it narrows down everything into the rubric of both intellect and emotion, wherein it doesn't matter whether you have a master's from an Ivy University, it doesn't matter if you're well-traveled or not, people can basically understand personal stories because we feel pain, we feel joy, and there's a certain commonality in all of us, regardless of our political or religious belief. We're all basically humans, and we have the same emotions, and we have the same issues.
And that's one of the stories that you cover in your film. We'd like to air a clip from that.
This is actually part of the 10-minute preview that we have online on flyingwellmuslim.com. And this is the story, basically, of, as I mentioned earlier, of Talat Hamdani and her son, Salman. And we interviewed Talat last year prior to the 9/11 anniversary. And she speaks about Salman and the kind of boy that he was, the kind of son that he was. So it's very moving. And caps everything by saying that they have not really fully recovered. I mean, she doesn't say it in those words, but you can feel it if you listen to her and if you are able to watch the clip online. And it's a very moving story of a mother about her son.
We'll play that clip now.
Passion and selflessness prompted Salman, a trained paramedic and police cadet, to rush to the aid of victims on that fateful September morning.
Salman, he loved children. He wanted to be a medical doctor. You know, he was very compassionate, very kind. Like if someone is in an accident or someone is injured or hurt, you know, we could see their pain, you know, but I think he could feel their pain.
Salman did not make it to work that morning, and he never came home. After he disappeared, the U.S. media, FBI, and the police department speculated that he was involved in the attacks because of his Muslim name. 6 months later, the truth came to light. It was discovered he died helping World Trade Center victims. His remains were found at Ground Zero, and belatedly, Salman's name was cleared, his honor restored.
Given the climate of the country at the time, you know, it was a natural backlash. That if you have a Muslim name, you are racially profiled. That's it. Straightforward. Since 9/11, Islam and terrorism have become synonymous. And the administration is promoting this viewpoint. So Muslims get afraid. There's no need to be afraid of anybody. This is your basic right. That's why the civil liberties are being curtailed by the Patriot Act. And that's what we have to fight for. We have to fight for our civil liberties, God-given rights. So that is something that we need as a community to focus upon. And we need to work on that. There's no need to be afraid.
Flying While Muslim is a story that is familiar to a group of people who have had a very rude awakening from the American dream. It is the account of ordinary men and women who were singled out and made to feel like outsiders in their own country because of their race or religious belief or their ethnic origin.
That was Talat Hamdani in the new film, Flying While Muslim. Your company is called Media for Human Rights, and there are so many different issues to choose from. Why did this issue speak to you?
It actually, to be honest, it took a life of its own. We were just doing a story about Talat for 9/11, and then during the course of our research, we found out there are a lot of stories out there about racial religious profiling that you don't see in mainstream media. And we felt the compelling need to bring those stories out there of these people and just create a space for dialogue.
What do you see as some of the solutions? You mentioned earlier you felt like there were real legal and maybe practical solutions to help solve the problems of racial profiling, especially post 9/11. What were some of those that you found?
Well, number one, one of the things that actually has been emphasized is that there's a need for public awareness and education in terms of making a lot of the public realize and also to neutralize the kind of information they receive from particular media outlets, to neutralize that and to create an awareness that, well, you know, Muslims, Arabs, South Asians are basically regular people who just want to live their lives and live in safe environments and basically have the same opportunities as other people have in this country. And number two, from the conversations that we've had from lawyers, from Amnesty, from the ACLU, and from NYU as well, there is definitely an urgent need to come up with a legal platform, which is currently financially and logistically difficult for a lot of these individuals. But there is that need to create measures to seek redress for people who feel that they've been mistreated or victimized by particular enforcement agencies or even by fellow citizens, because the issue of racial profiling is not only is that it's institutional, it actually boils down into private profiling, wherein people are deputized and are made to, you know, watch out, like just any quote-unquote suspicious behavior. At the same time, how do you define suspicious behavior? If I may, there's a story I would like to share. Kazim Ali, who was actually a professor at the university in Pennsylvania, this is a guy who's a poet and who teaches literature. Kazim Ali is basically, I think he's of Egyptian descent. He's Muslim, he's brown skin, and he drives this really interesting-looking car, which is sort of like very hip. But at the same time, during Earth Day, what happened was that he wanted to recycle old poetry. So he parked his car, got out of his car, put a box of papers beside a trash can, and left. While he was doing that, an ROTC cadet saw him, and all that kid saw was this brown man leaving a box beside a trash can. And so what happened was that he called 911, he called the cops basically. The whole university was shut down for hours.
Which university?
Of Shippensburg. Basically, the cops went to Kazim's house and started sort of like asking him questions. But then the whole fact was that the whole university was shut down because of brown-skinned man left a box beside the trash can during Earth Day was reason enough, you know, to create this whole paranoia and definition of suspicious behavior.
Lyra Porras-Garzon, documentary filmmaker, then her new film is Flying While Muslim. Thanks so much for joining us on Law and Disorder and for really exploring these crucial issues that we think are very important to bring to the big screens.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
That's lawanddisorder.org.